We were 2 days away from closing Kogi. And what I told the team was, if we're going to go down, we're going to go down the Kogi way. And what we did was we just started giving food away for free. And everyone just started donating. I made a promise to everyone that every penny that came in, we would make sure that goes and serves a hot meal to someone.
Chef Roy Choi talking about the early days of the pandemic and how close he came to going out of business. We'll listen back to my conversation with him later in the show. First, after being postponed for months, the Grammys are finally happening this Sunday. When the nominations were announced last fall, the category for Best New Artist included some obvious contenders like pop star Olivia Rodrigo, the rapper Sweetie, and Phineas. Also nominated is a Brooklyn-based Pakistani artist named Aruj Aftab. That's the song Mohabbat from her third album, Vulture Prince. That song was also nominated for Best Global Music Performance at this year's Grammys, making her the first Pakistani woman to be recognized by the Recording Academy. Aftab's lyrics are sung mostly in Urdu, her native language. Her work is also inspired by Sufi music, which is an ancient form of Islamic poetry. And when I spoke with Aruj Aftab earlier this year, I began by congratulating her and asking her if she was surprised by the nominations.
Yeah, very surprised, very pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. And you were in Pakistan at the time, I understand, when you heard.
I was, a rare thing. But there I was in Pakistan, yes.
Well, why is it a rare thing? You grew up there and came here when you were, what, 19 years old? Is that right, to study music?
Something like that, yeah. I don't know. I haven't really gone back that much since I came here. I really just sort of hit the ground running when I got here, you know, and really stayed super immersed in music and started building a world of my own.
So you went to the Berklee College of Music, I understand. And had you grown up performing a lot of music as a child?
No, not at all. I think as a child, I was kind of grew up in a household of a lot of music listening, for sure, and music appreciation. And then didn't really start performing until maybe even like my second or third year at Berklee. But of course, like, performing as in, you know, kind of playing guitar with friends in high school, or like, I had a little garage band in high school too, but nothing really out there.
We have a recording of you singing the Leonard Cohen song Hallelujah. Can you set that up? How old were you when you sang it, and what were the circumstances?
I don't know, maybe 18, 19, maybe younger. I just really loved Leonard Cohen a lot. And then I discovered Jeff Buckley's version. And then I discovered just Jeff Buckley, you know, the Grace album. And like, you know, my mind was blown. Such deep, sad, beautiful, everything that I love, haunting vibes. But yeah, I just really, it was just, you know, it's like your teen angst and everything just kind of gets together and just all kind of clicked at the same time, and I performed that song in that way, and I guess it just like really reached, it really kind of translated to a lot of people.
Well, let's hear a little bit from your recording of
God.
Hallelujah.
Why? I sound like a little baby.
Okay, well, let's hear it anyway.
All right, fine.
You hear at night, it's not somebody who's seen the light. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
That is beautiful. Why don't you like that?
no, I like it. And when it starts playing, then I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, it is good. I mean, the dynamics are so there. I feel like maybe that sort of youth fire, you know, like not afraid of really like belting, and it's very emotive for sure.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's hear you now. And this is from your latest album. And this song is called Last Night. And it's the only song on the album that is sung in English. And this is a translated poem from the poet, the 13th century poet, Rumi.
So beautiful. So beautiful like the moon. So beautiful like the moon, so beautiful like the moon, even brighter than the sun. Was even brighter than the sun. Was even brighter than the sun.
So your voice has definitely deepened and matured. That is just beautiful. Talk about how you put this song together, because here you do have the words of a 13th century poet, and then you also have a modern reggae sound in there.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Sufi poetry goes with reggae, if you know what I mean, to a certain degree, right?
Well, I don't, so explain.
You know, I feel like some of the ethos of reggae, Rastafarianism, you know, they kind of overlap in their sort of way.
Yeah.
You know, in the kind of romanticization of intoxication and, you know, the substance, the joy, you know, all of those kind of things kind of go together. For me, I've always felt that way. Like, I feel like it's that kind of poetry too that was really kind of resonating with me. Like, very minimalist, not a lot of words, like comparative to Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, where it's just there's so much being said, and it's so, you're in a story of lyricism, you know what I mean? Like, here it's just like there's a thought and it's being repeated, and you're emoting a lot, but at the same time, it's super minimal and there's not a lot really happening. And so I think it's that sort of phase of spaciness and dub, and then Rumi's minimal, like, just a few words saying so much kind of vibe that came together for me in that moment and felt right.
That's interesting, because I'm thinking that both lead you to a spiritual plane. Both the Leonard Cohen song, of course, Hallelujah, but what you're talking about, the repetition of the same phrase over and over again, can, again, lift you into an altered consciousness. At least that's a thought in many religions, but also Sufism.
Yeah, I think that's one of their core, right? It's like the cycle, the circular motion of the world, and minimalism in general, like less, simpleness, you know, all of that. It's also math, it's also architecture, it's just, you know, it's just like a simpler sort of, it's just really purely minimalism in that sense. It's Sufi poetry for sure, and definitely Rumi's vibe is that way, so.
And are you religious? Are you particularly religious in your life?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, I grew up with a religion being there by default, right? Like so many of us. And like, I guess we grew up around it. Like, but yeah, I mean, I try to be a good person, but that's just inherently impossible, right? Because of the push and pull of the world. It's hard to think about life along those terms or identity, because so much of religion has been such a like basis of so many problems that like just even the word feels like no.
Yeah.
So it's like really just not about that for me.
What is it about for you in these songs?
I think it's about love and the deepness of, you know, I guess just the reality of the world, you know, like how it can fill you with so much disdain for it because of the constant, it's like, it's so relentless in the way that it brings you joy and it brings you so much sadness and it like gives you things and takes things away and you're just kind of in this washing machine cycle. But then without that, everything is pointless, you know what I mean? So kind of just trying to have the most integrity and putting those thoughts and feelings kind of out there into the music. A very personal music is kind of what I've been trying to make, you know.
Well, let's hear a little bit more from your latest album. This one is called Dia Hay.
Dia
That is the song Dia Hay by my guest Aruj Aftab. And you're singing in Urdu there. What what are you saying?
Great pronunciation, by the way. Spot on.
Thank you.
Dia Hai Dil Agar Usko Bashar Hai Kya Kahiye. I'm saying if I give my heart to whoever, what can you really do about it if you give your heart away? That's kind of what I think it says.
And this is a poem by a famous poet in Pakistan named Mirza Ghalib, right? Written in the 19th century.
Yes. He was writing about the sort of exceptional triangle of two, I would say for simplicity, like there's the lover and then there's the beloved and then there's the friend. So it's kind of like it's not, you think it'll be a typical love triangle that the friend falls in love with the beloved and the lover, you know, but actually the poem turns towards the friendship between the lover and the friend and is like, well, now that this friend of mine is also in love with my beloved, I have to kind of figure out how to navigate my friendship turning into sort of like a weird animosity situation. So it's really cool for me. I felt that is, you know, you would imagine that it would be something else, but then, because, you know, in love triangles, they don't always explore what's happening on the back end, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I really kind of really liked where it went, and that's kind of what I think the song is saying.
Were you involved in a love triangle at the time that you recorded that?
No, not at all. No, I just liked the concept of it. It's kind of romantic, you know? It's kind of not about anything at the end. It's just about, like, the power of this love and it being shared and the understanding of these things that happen. Like, just talking in a very simple and real way, which is what I really appreciate.
Yeah. But listening to it and not knowing what the words mean, it does have a melancholy sound to it. It sounds sad to me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that not the right interpretation?
I think it is. You know, there's a sadness, an inherent sadness in love in general. I think we would all agree, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also like a sweetness in it, right? Like this melancholic kind of hope and desire for another love, you know, or for the love or for any relationship to become have more love. So I feel like that's kind of what's happening in the song.
So getting back to this idea that you were nominated at the Grammys, you know, here you are talking about ideas from mystical Urdu poetry from many centuries ago, and then you're going to be at the Grammys, which is the most kind of American pop culture phenomenon there is around this time of year It just seems like it's a bit of a culture clash. How do you feel about it?
I feel like it's kind of great. You know, I kind of feel like there's all these weird idiosyncrasies in the music industry, right? Like the Grammys being so inherently American, but also just being like the highest accolade in the world for music. You know, it's like clashes with, you know, like those two things really clash. So it's hard to say that it's American because it's also so globally sought after. And I just think that there are millions of people all over the world who listen to pop music, right? But then there are also millions of people all over the world who listen to alternative music, who listen to this music that I'm making, which really comes out of like 20 years of living in New York and 5 years of studying jazz in Boston and being from Pakistan. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It doesn't get more New York, diverse, melting pot, utopia, Americana than that, right? It feels really good. I'm saying so much, but you know what I mean? Like, it feels right, and it feels like the Academy is doing a good thing here, where it's realizing that this is also popular, but just from a different lens, and it deserves to be in the running as a Best New Artist. And one of the biggest things is that the American audiences are okay now listening to music that isn't in English, you know, because everywhere else in the world they've been doing this for a long time very easily, right? This is happening, and it's like a giant breakthrough, to be honest, and good for everyone, right? Like, more music to listen to, you know? So yeah, I'm really happy. I'm super stoked. I can't wait to actually be there and hang out.
That's Arooj Aftab. Her album Vulture Prince is out now, and the Grammys air this Sunday on CBS. Coming up, my conversation with comedian Al Madrigal about his LA-inspired comic book, Primos. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A new comic book series is putting Latino characters in the lead. It's called Primos, and it follows three Mexican-American cousins of Mayan heritage who come together to, of course, save the world from evil. Set between Mexico and Los Angeles, it was created by the actor and comedian Al Madrigal. He used to be a correspondent for The Daily Show. When I spoke with him last month, I began by asking him why he decided to make a comic book.
Well, it sort of all does start with The Daily Show, because when I first got out there, I did a podcast called Comic Book Live. And the other guy on the podcast, it takes out a picture of, you know, on an iPad. He's scrolling through his iPad, and I see that there's a 9-year-old boy playing basketball. And I go, oh, you have my son loves basketball. They look around the same age. And then he takes off his jacket. He has a San Francisco shirt on. Oh, you're from San Francisco? I went to this high school. And then he said, oh, I went to that same high school. And we discovered very quickly that we had that and a ton of other weird stuff in common. Both half Mexicans, both with Korean wives. We had both had the exact same favorite restaurant in San Francisco, a city with, you know, hundreds of great restaurants. So we became instant friends, and that guy turned out to be the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics at the time, Axel Alonso, who's a fellow half-Mexican who went to my high school. So we started talking about the lack of any Latino, Latinx, Latine, Latina superheroes and decided to do something about it. So there you go.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, most people would just like vacation together or whatever, but you guys, you decided to make a comic book together.
My friend Dave, he goes, I wouldn't even have commented on his kid's basketball photo. So,
so that started it all.
Yeah, that, exactly.
Well, are you a comic book aficionado to begin with?
I was aficionado, no. But, you know, when I did get to the Daily Show, I first of all, I didn't make any of my sports teams when I was in high school, and I really wanted to. So mm-hmm. I found myself at a comic book store picking up, you know, whatever I could get into, and sort of, you know, comic book stores are weird. Either they're super welcoming, or there's, you know, the comic book nerd from The Simpsons criticizing your purchases. So grabbed a book called West Coast Avengers, and then got to the Daily Show, and everybody was reading Walking Dead, Goon. When I met Axel, he turned me on to a bunch of books, and so sort of got back into it, and then again doing research for this really jumped back in. So
okay, so tell us about the story. The main character is a guy named, or a kid named Ricky Pascal, and he's from Boyle Heights, and he's a bit of a, what, how would you describe him, like a party boy?
He's just like the CD student who, you know, is at some Euphoria. Do these parties even exist? Do Euphoria style parties exist? I hope not. But he's at one of them. And he's drinking. And he just took drugs from some kid named Gilberto Suarez, and he has a couple of visions, pukes, and then realizes that he is late to take care of his brother, and rushes home to find his, you know, long lost Mayan emperor uncle standing in his living room, and realizes that he's the most powerful sorcerer in the universe, and he has a job to do. And it's now it's time for him to fulfill his potential, which no one thought he had any of. So,
at least of all him.
Totally. No, he's always shunned responsibility, and now the weight of the world is on his shoulders. So he has to gather other descendants in this sort of protector line of his family, and save the world. You know, it all comes back to like to DNA and ancestry. I was lucky enough to stumble upon this Mayan emperor, Kanique Janab Pakal, who ruled from 603 to 683, who's supposedly a descendant of the first mother. So I put this 17-year-old Boyle Heights kid in that line. And now he's, you know, got all this responsibility that, you know, he can't even barely take care of himself, let alone others.
So how much research did you do, and how much did you learn about, I guess, your, well, one half of your heritage?
Yes. So I did a good amount, you know, and again, and I was lucky to stumble upon Kanique, and there was so much there. Everywhere I looked in terms of the weaponry, everything is just so amazing, so much to draw upon for the book, because they're all sort of gifted artifacts that awaken their power. And then lucky enough to team up with this incredible artist named Carlo Barberi, who does Deadpool. So he would draw some things that would inspire me to change the story a little bit. And it was very much a collaborative process. So lucky to have, you know, a bunch of great stuff to help us out.
That's so cool. So, I mean, you make a joke in your stand-up about how you don't really speak fluent Spanish. And so is this in a way to help you get back to that side of your past, your ancestry?
I mean, sure. I always felt connected. You know, Latinos are, you know, weird in that most groups don't have this. All Latinos are out to out-Latino each other. So I always felt pretty connected to it. It's just other people wanting to say, hey, man, you're this, you're that, you're the, you know, I'm more Latino than you are. And so, you know, and my dad just grew up at a funky time where he was, you know, graduated from high school in 1957. It was not as cool to be Latino as it is now. And not that it's super cool right now, because there's still people that vilify us. But he, you know, needed to assimilate. So that's how I ended up where I am. But in terms of, you know, me doing this for any reason, the main purpose I'm doing this is because it needs to be done. You see it with TV, 20% of the population and 5% of the characters in film and television. Comic books was worse. You know, it's just there's no Latino superheroes. So somebody had to.
Yeah. Why hasn't there been a Latino superhero or a major one, at least?
I think they were. I mean, it's the same thing with everything. It's like they you know, all these characters are created in the late 50s, early 60s, and they were all, you know, white guys. And so I'm hoping that any Latina, Latino, Latinx kid, you know, that's 17 years old that stumbles into a comic book store and finds this, sees themselves on the page, which is be awesome, and it inspires them to do sort of the same thing and follow whatever creative path that they're on.
Well, speaking of, this is a comic book, but you're thinking maybe it could become a TV show or it could become a movie?
I mean, this is, again, you know, the problem is with TV and the problems with everything, just all forms of media, you know, so it's a comic book, television show, reality show, whatever it is, you know, we're not there.
Yeah. You are creating a TV show, or you have created it. It's forthcoming on ABC called Gorillas, right? And you're playing a guy who works for an oil company.
There we go. I'm sorry. I'm going to jump in. Dead at ABC, shopping it around elsewhere, but have like Jaime Camille attached to it, who's incredibly popular from Jane the Virgin. Jane the Virgin creator Jenny Snyder Ehrman working with me on it. So just when you think, you know, you've put together the perfect package, you know, it's just not right for
they killed
people.
It?
It is not going forward at ABC. They ordered a second script, but it's we're pursuing other options right now.
And how disappointing. I mean, this goes to exactly what you're talking about.
Kind of. I mean, it's just the way it goes. It's, you know, unless you hit the right person at the right time, it's a little tricky. And even if you do that, so many different things have to fall in place. You know, again, TV development is really daunting. There's a lot of... so many hoops to jump through. I always remember like doing a pilot and then, you know, you have that uncle or aunt who's like, when does that come out again? It's like, it might not come out.
Ever.
And then if it did come out, no one could watch it. It could be dead after three episodes. So we really don't get our hopes up at all. You sort of just make them and cross your fingers. And so, yeah, it's just difficult to explain to people how this works, but there's 50 hoops to jump through, and you know, each one is trickier than the one before it.
And that's generally the case in Hollywood, right? For every project. But I wonder what it's like trying to pitch a Latino-centered project if you feel like there are more hoops to go through or not, or you just don't know if it was canceled because of that or just other reasons.
I mean, pitching to the right type of Latino that can identify with your experience too. Like, you know, again, you know, I remember right when I got to Hollywood and we got a Latino executive on the phone from New York who had gone to Columbia and was Puerto Rican. We were pitching a very Mexican story. And the guy said, well, that's not my experience. So I really don't identify with this at all. And just again, like even when you have that what you think is the right advocate in place, you know, it's hard when we can't even figure out what to call each other. Then you expect other people to know. It's we're in a tricky spot.
Are you talking about like Latino, Latinx, Latine? Is that what you're referring to?
Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine, Chicano, Chicana, Hispanic. Yeah, it's there's the eight things that people, you know, like. And whatever anybody wants to be called is fine with me. I don't care.
What do you want to be called?
Just Latino, Latina. But whatever you want to call me is fine with me.
So how many of these comic books have you done?
I am just finishing the fourth book right now. So it's I finally know how everything's going to wrap up. It's evolved over the course of writing it. It's super cool. I think it's a great story amongst comics. I think it's just got to be intriguing and good. And it doesn't matter who's in it. It could be a Korean story. It could be, you know, Japanese. Whoever's in it just does it. I think this is just a quality comic book and a great story. And yes, it does draw on Maya culture and history, but again, I just hope it stands out and is comic book readers all enjoy it, not just, you know, Latino or Latinx comic book readers.
Well, Al, thanks for coming on the show. It was great talking with you.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And good luck.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I need it.
Don't we all? Al Madrigal, yeah. Actor, stand-up comedian, and creator of the comic book series Primos. Coming up, Chef Roy Choi on the struggles small restaurants have paying a decent wage and staying afloat. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Kogi, the food truck that inspired 1,000 imitators, both here in LA and everywhere across the country. Kogi's Korean barbecue tacos were an instant hit when the truck started roving around the streets in 2008. And they earned Chef Roy Choi a place among the city's top culinary ranks. Well, since then, Choi has launched several more trucks, a couple of brick-and-mortar restaurants, a catering business, and a few TV shows, including a PBS series about social activism. It's called Broken Bread. The show just wrapped its second season a couple of weeks ago, and in it, Choi tackles big issues like the impact of the pandemic on restaurant workers and what the industry should do about it.
It's estimated that undocumented workers comprise 10% of all restaurant employees in the U.S., and as many as 40% in cities like L.A. and New York. When they lost their jobs, there was nothing to fall back on.
I spoke with Chef Roy Choi back in February.
Hey, Madeline. Look, Ma, I'm on Press Play. Man, this is so exciting. This is a big deal for me. I listen to you all the time.
You do? Oh, well, it's a big deal for me because I eat at your trucks all the time. So there you go.
Okay, there we go. This is a love fest here.
It is a love fest. All right, well, let's talk about what has happened to your trucks and your restaurant with this pandemic. So how did it affect your restaurants and what's going on?
It hit us directly in the heart, you know. March 2020, when everything hit our world for all of us in every aspect of life, the restaurant industry got hit the hardest, you know. Our industry itself is already a very fragile industry economically. Most restaurants that you all eat at or frequent or may even look busy from the outside looking in, they're usually just a couple days away from being bankrupt, you know. So the model itself is very fragile. And what the pandemic did was it exposed everything. You know, you saw restaurants crumbling within the first week of shutdown.
Well, what about for you?
For us, too. We were 2 days away from closing Kogi. Can you believe that?
Oh, my God. Really?
Because everyone was scared. And what I told the team was, if we're going to go down, we're going to go down the Kogi way. And what we did was we just started giving food away for free. I said, like, listen, man, you know, if this is inevitable, let's just do it the way that we started, you know, with free spirit and nothing to lose. And so we did that. We started feeding anyone who lost their jobs. We started doing pickups and drop-offs. We did drive-throughs in Whittier, all, you know, San Gabriel, South LA, everything. The Kogi fans, they came out in force on the internet. They asked us to set up a Venmo account and everyone just started donating. I made a promise to everyone that every penny that came in, we would make sure that goes and serves a hot meal to someone. What happened to Kogi is we lost 60% of our business overnight, because 60% of our business is catering. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with like KCRW might hire us for a party, or we do a lot of like television and movie sets, you know, like a big chunk of our life every day during the day was going to office complexes. Everyone stopped going to the office. So we lost everything overnight. And it was the donations that kept us alive.
That is such a great thing and really heartwarming. What about government aid? Did that help at all?
It took a while. We got a little bit for the Paycheck Protection Program, and that was enough. See, our goal was just to make sure that we didn't have to lay off anyone. And that was really it. And Kogi survived. And, you know, it gave me hope. And I saw a glimpse of like a world where, in a way, like the idea of money or profit doesn't exist. That we're all just in it together. And, you know, it felt very nature-like. Like a tree with a nut and a squirrel, you know, like it just felt like it's all supposed to fit together.
You talked to a young woman who is a Vietnamese chef. Yeah. She is committed to paying her workers a living wage. Like, I think it's $18 an hour, right? something like that.
18 plus pool tips comes out to about 25.
That's a lot. And she admits that she doesn't know how she's going to make it sustainable. How can she?
That's in our first episode, The Future of Restaurants. And the restaurant's called Bea U in Silver Lake. And her name is Uen Lee. Who knows? You know, for a lot of us, you know, what the great thing about Broken Bread is that sometimes when you're swimming upstream and you're trying to do things like outside of the norm, you're trying to lead with your heart, you feel alone in the world sometimes. And the great thing about Broken Bread was that I realized I wasn't alone. There are certain things you feel in your gut, but your brain tells you that's impossible. And the brain is telling her that this is completely unsustainable. You know, the restaurant industry itself only has, especially a small to-go restaurant like hers, you only have about a 5% margin to begin with in profit. And so with that, what happens is people get exploited. And it's just a nature of this kind of old system that we live in. And so she's like, you know, screw that. I'm not going to give up my standards and my dignity and my integrity of what I believe in just to run a restaurant. I'm going to run a restaurant with all of those things. And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, you know, it's going to last as long as it's going to last.
Yeah.
She's paying people way above minimum wage. She's charging way below what she could for the food. She's making sure people have sick pay, vacation pay, benefits. She's trying to raise the boat for everybody. On paper, none of that adds up. But in life, it does add up, and she's thriving. What does that say about us all maybe taking a chance and looking at these old systems and saying they don't work anymore?
So maybe she's making up for it in volume, like she's just selling more?
The practical answer is making up for it in volume, using creative techniques and recipes, using a long-form cooking, what we call slow cooking, so that you have better margins and you're using... You have no waste, things like that. But I want to say, and I don't know if this is the right place for it, Madeline, but I want to say that there's something beyond the tangible as well. Hmm. I believe in that stuff. You know, oh. I believe that if like everything on paper says it's not going to work, but you put all your heart into it, it's like public radio, man. This shouldn't work. You know what I'm saying? Like it shouldn't work, but it does. And I feel like there's something that beyond ourselves in the universe, that if we put everything into it, that it's going to work.
Let's talk about the role of restaurants in gentrification. You address that in the series as well.
Sure.
And not frequently in the series. I guess I'm wondering, her restaurant, while small and committed to, you know, living wages and sustainable prices for people, is still part of a changing neighborhood that could be called a gentrifying neighborhood, Virgil Village, right?
Oh, yeah. We focus on three areas, really. You know, her restaurant, Virgil Village. We focus on Chinatown with My Story, with Chego. And we focus on Leimert Park, which is at the heart of gentrification. But mm-hmm. as far as the village goes, where Bea U is at, that's like a case study for a lot of what happened in the neighborhood, like in Los Angeles with gentrification. You're talking about a working class neighborhood, a mostly Latino neighborhood, where one restaurant opened and caused a chain of events. And that restaurant was called Squirrel.
Yeah.
And it caused a chain of events that took a neighborhood, you know, that was low rent, that housed a lot of people that worked in the service industry or the blue collar industry. And all of a sudden it became Virgil Village. Everything changed. You know, people were being displaced. Rents were going up. There was entitlement. I think where we are now, we can't claim ignorance anymore. Maybe there was a time when Squirrel opened that people who are going there could say, oh, you know, like I'm just here to get whatever I'm here to get. I'm contributing to the neighborhood. But now I don't think we can claim that ignorance anymore.
So what do you do? I guess, what do you do as a consumer or a, you know, someone who wants to support local businesses? And it was a local business, or it is, I guess it still exists, but yet doesn't want to gentrify, someone who wants to have a good meal. What do you do?
Well, part of it, I think, is rests on the shoulders of the owner. Like mm-hmm. you see a new generation after Squirrel, like a Bea U with Uen, she's making a difference. She's making sure she's understanding the demographics and the conditions of the neighborhood as she opens a restaurant. But the other thing as a consumer, and I think we get there in the Chinatown episode, at least we try to, is that when I speak of that we can't be ignorant anymore, I think that we have to create a surcharge or a shared profit by the establishment, and the prices have to be a little higher. We should all know when we're going to a place as a consumer that has maybe taken over or popped up in an area that is most likely a neighborhood of community of color or a marginalized neighborhood, and they're there because the rent is cheap, right? Mm-hmm. And so we as consumers have to be open to paying a surcharge that goes towards a oversight committee fund that works as a mediator between development, growth, and also sustainability. So that would apply, if we could go into the past, that would apply everywhere from Bushwick, Brooklyn, all the way to Silver Lake. But now that we're in the present moving forward, I think that anything moving forward, we as a collective food community, as a culture community, as a seeking community of new things, that is something that is our responsibility, you know, moving forward. We can't just claim ignorance and say, well, you know, like, I only want to pay $4 for this, but you're choosing to go to this place knowing damn well where they're opening. So I think it's important that you should be able to pay $6 instead of $3 or $4.
Where would that money go?
That money goes to a committee or like an oversight fund that is head by organizations that are fighting against gentrification. Because I'm not against growth either. I want to make that clear, because I'm also a business person, right? So I'm not against growth, but I am for tender and loving growth. And I think we need to be checked. This capitalist system like pulls out the animal in us. If you hear of a new place in town, you know, we flock to it, right? And the writers can't stop writing about it. The consumers can't stop wanting to get into it. And we lose all of our senses and all of our just righteousness of knowing what is right. And we just end up becoming very selfish as consumers and as people.
It's complicated, though, because like, I'm watching some of your episodes and I'll see a place that you highlight and it looks so delicious and I want to go there.
You want to go.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the restaurant owner would like my money. But at the same time, if many more of me goes to this other restaurant, then that starts perhaps a gentrification process that might in the long run not be healthy for the neighborhood. So it's complicated.
I do hear what you're saying, and you are right when it's an outsider coming in. But there's also a positive side to this, and there is an inspirational side. In Broken Bread, there's a whole new entrepreneur that's coming from the inside out, right? So in that case, we've evolved just a little bit to where now your support could actually be beneficial. So you're seeing that in episode 5 with Voodoo Vegan and Nature's Thirst Trap and Haroon Coffee, all in Leimert. You're seeing that in Boyle Heights, you know, with Machin and Mirpa Grill. You know, you're seeing that in Chinatown, Avenue 26. And so you're seeing a whole new wave of entrepreneurs that are coming from inside the neighborhood and not outside. So there is hope.
Yeah. So you mentioned Leimert Park. Let's talk about Englewood, another Black community. There's SoFi Stadium. What's happening there when it comes to neighborhood restaurants possibly being bulldozed and the history being changed quickly?
Oh, it's happening right under your noses. It's happening as you and I speak right now.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not just Inglewood. It's like the volcano that happened in Tonga, and you get the waves here in Santa Monica. It reverberates all the way to Watts, to Linwood, Crenshaw, everywhere. People are getting displaced, especially in the projects that I represent over in the that I'm a part of and family with in the Jordan Downs. You know, you're going through a whole development process where people are being pushed out. Mm-hmm. From the outside, it said, oh, well, this is government housing. These are buildings that were built in World War II. Like, don't you want something new? But what people don't realize is in a community like Watts, these are generations and generations of families that have history and stories and poetry built into the soil of that ground. And it's not as easy just saying, you know, just move to Victorville or just move to Lancaster.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about, you know, again, you know, life. And you're seeing it directly through Leimert and through Crenshaw. And what we try to show in that episode in Lemert is the unimaginable idea and threat of, could Lemert not be a Black neighborhood in 10 to 15 years? It's almost absurd to even think of, right? It would be the same as saying, could Harlem not be a Black neighborhood, you know?
Well, that same conversation has been happening in Harlem.
Absolutely, right? And it's happening right now in Crenshaw because of the Metro line and because of SoFi Stadium and because of everything that's happening with development and gentrification and the need for housing and the need for condos. It's a tough thing to grapple with, but our show is not as heavy as your show. I'm not as smart a host, so I use food as a lens to be able to bring things back to like a little bit of a kind of a touchy-feely moment where we're like, okay, we'll use a certain part of the show to identify the problem, but instead of getting into like debates about it or political angles, we try to say, okay, here's the problem. And you know what? Here are people on the ground that are just saying, no way. And we just hope that their stories inspire you, you know? The one thing that you'll see in Lemert is that there is a resilience and a strength and a power. Even the most powerful people are scared, you know? Because they don't own any land. So everyone is at the mercy of whatever's gonna happen with development. And that's something that we're addressing, and hopefully the people that we cover are doing something about. You know, we're showing young entrepreneurs trying to make a difference, trying to build legacy businesses.
It's so inspiring. It's just so, just to see how hard people are fighting for this and the ideals that they have. And it's just, it is really inspiring. And also it makes me really hungry watching the show.
Yeah, right.
You know,
that's the whole idea of the show. And I'm glad it does make you hungry, because food is our Trojan horse. It is our weapon, our positive weapon to bring everyone in. If we're going to confront the inequalities of life, it would require a lot of us to take a deep, hard look in the mirror. And that's really tough. But if we do it over food, instead of taking a look in the mirror and taking the blame, over food, we can all put down our guard and say, you know what? This is silly. This is stupid. This is ridiculous. And we're all going to do something about it, because it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that millions and millions of kids are going without any access to any vitamins or nutrients in their food, that they're only eating preservatives and sugars and sodium and processed foods, not only in their choices outside of school, but also in their school.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, so it just seems, you know, like if you were to say that for your own family or children, for anyone that has the fortunate ability not to be within those systems, you know, you would never stand for it. And what we're trying to say is, if you don't stand for it for yourself, why would you stand for it for anyone else? Mm-hmm. And we're trying to, like Uyen said, just raise the boat for everyone. Just make it even. And then you can have success beyond that. But people shouldn't be living below human levels. No one should.
So do you advise that we go to these restaurants and patronize them and these places that you highlight in the show?
Absolutely.
We should be doing and not feel like we might be contributing to gentrification or anything like that, but that we should go in with a spirit of curiosity and compassion and a healthy appetite.
Absolutely. Because again, what we're showing in our show is a whole new wave of entrepreneurs from the inside out. So you shouldn't feel guilty about supporting Compton Community Garden, Haroon Coffee, Voodoo Vegan, Nature's Thirst Trap, Know Us Without You, Machine, Milpa Grill, Sarah's Market, Kernel of Truth Tortillas. I could do roll call all day with you. This is what we've all been working towards, is not the outside coming in, but the inside coming out.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for spotlighting these businesses and the issues, and thanks for your delicious food.
Thank you for your delicious content.
My pleasure. That's Chef Roy Choi. You can watch Broken Bread on demand anytime on the PBS app. Well, that's it for this special edition of Press Play. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at KCRW Press Play, or tweet us. Tell us what you like, what you want to hear more of. Also, you can download or subscribe to our podcast at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. Have a great rest of your day. I'll see you tomorrow.